So welcome to the second in our series on the Aguna crisis, co-sponsored by ORA, the Organization for the Resolution of Agunot. Last week we looked at how the Aguna crisis developed, how Jewish law developed its requirement of mutual consent, that both parties in a divorce need to agree for the divorce in order for the divorce to be in effect. And thus that leads to the Aguna crisis, because if only one member of the marriage says yes, the other party remains married halachically, which creates tremendous complications. Thus, the person remains an aguna. Generally, it's the woman. She remains an aguna, chained to her husband. And we looked at last week how, ironically, that developed from the best of intentions, how classically divorce was undesirable for women. And so halacha, from its various competing systems to construct divorce, went for the model of mutual consent, which nowadays leads to the problem of the aguna crisis. But for many years, the very factor of mutual consent was actually an advantage for many women who did not want to leave marriages because it was generally undesirable. We also saw last week that another problem that exacerbates or amplifies the Aguna crisis is the inability of Batei Dinim to actually enforce their laws. It used to be, and this is going to be somewhat of a recurring theme for today also, it used to be that if you were a Beit Din, you could demand that someone is obligated to give a divorce, and you could use all sorts of measures possible. You could beat the guy, you could financially fine them, and obviously communal pressure. Also, nowadays, all we are really left able to do is communal pressure, and even that is ineffective in many parts of the community where the communal pressure isn't so great. If you are either an irreligious Jew or a Jew who lives in an incredibly large Jewish community, many people aren't particularly sensitive to this issue. You can always find another shul to go to. And so we looked last week at how the Aguna crisis really came to be. What we're going to do over the next 3 weeks is look at various solutions that have been offered and assess their merits and their pitfalls, and really try to understand, and we're going to talk about this at some length today, the broader issue that affects almost all of the solutions proposed to the Aguna crisis. But we're going to do that by looking at one of the most fascinating solutions offered to solve the Aguna crisis, which is the New York Get Law. And it's not officially called that, but it's exists to be a get law, and many other states apparently also have get laws these days on their books. And in doing so, we're going to get a window into one of the major halachic topics that governs divorce, which is a get me'usa, a coerced get, which is invalid. If I put a gun to someone's head and say, give that person the get, that's not valid. He has to do so out of his own free will, as we're going to see today. And so the question of get me'usa is one of the major questions that concerns primarily the New York get law, but also rests at the back of many of these solutions, because if you're going to create a situation in which the get has been forced, it's not valid, and thus the problem is not solved. But we begin in 1983. So in 1983, a law was passed in New York with the intent to try and curb the Aguna crisis. And it was prepared in consultation with basically every, you know, part of the Orthodox spectrum were able to have a say in crafting this law. Rav Moshe Feinstein himself was apparently involved in its crafting, and this was the core part, source number one. So this is from the New York Domestic Relations Law. Things don't get more exciting than these kinds of things. Any party to a marriage, defined in subdivision one of this section, who commences a proceeding to annul the marriage or for a divorce, must allege in his or her verified complaint, one, that to the best of his or her knowledge that he or she has taken, or that he or she will take prior to the entry of final judgment, all steps solely within his or her power to remove any barrier to the defendant's remarriage following the annulment or divorce. Or number two, that the defendant has waived in writing the requirements of this subdivision. In other words, in a divorce, the person filing for divorce must sign a verified affidavit saying that they have removed all barriers to remarriage. This includes a religious barrier, because all barriers to remarriage prevents the other person from getting married. So in a situation where the husband has filed for divorce, he has to sign a valid affidavit, and he can be, you know, put for all the, perjured and everything else. He can be violate perjury and all these other things if he's lying. in order to get a civil divorce, he has to acknowledge he also has basically given a get. And there are heads of Batei Dinim, Rabbi Leib Landesman, who's the head of Kol Al Harabonim in Muncie, which is a well-known Beit Din in Muncie. He, in 1992, was interviewed, and he talked about the fact that he credited this New York state law as basically causing over 150 gittin. The husbands who otherwise would not have given their get in order to acquire the civil divorce did so in compliance with the New York get law of 1983, the first New York get law. And, you know, it sounds good, but there are a couple of major limitations with the 1983 get law. The first is that the only punishment that it can do is preventing civil divorce. So, if you are a recalcitrant husband who is refusing to give your wife a get, you can't remarry anyway. So the fact that you can't get a civil divorce isn't particularly powerful. If you're a recalcitrant husband, you are effectively, and we spoke last week a bit about Hetamei Rabbanim, but you're effectively giving up on the ability to remarry. So your inability to get a civil divorce, because you can't get married if you've not given a get, you can't get remarried if you're not given a get, you can't get remarried without a civil divorce. By not having a civil divorce, it doesn't really change it, because you're also not giving a get. Fundamentally also, either you care about halacha, and therefore without giving the get, you can't get married, or you don't care about halacha, and then the, you know, and then there are no adultery laws, so it doesn't prevent you from having sexual relationships with women anyway. The only situation that the 1983 New York get law stands to prevent is a man who wishes to remarry, cannot do so in the eyes of, obviously, halacha, because he's not given the get, but also civil law, the divorce won't be executed. So it's a major limitation, because it seriously reduces the incentive to divorce. The other major limitation is the very first kind of line. Any party to a marriage defined in subdivision 1 of this section who commences a proceeding to annul the marriage or for a divorce. You have to file for the divorce yourself. The person who files has to sign the affidavit, not the other party. In most situations of aguna, it's the woman who wants to escape the marriage. It's the woman who files for divorce. And so in such a situation, the husband is not compelled to sign any affidavit. He is not held by New York get law to sign that affidavit. It's only the party starting the divorce proceedings. And so even in New York get law, it's very easy to circumvent it. You just wait for the wife. If you want to be recalcitrant, you just need to wait for the wife to file for divorce first, and then you're not going to be held to this standard. So for those two reasons, and those are pretty major reasons, the 1983 get law isn't as effective as maybe people would have hoped. And this is kind of its challenge. It is halachically beautiful. It does nothing to challenge or contradict or in any way cause problems with how halacha understands divorce and get me'usa, which we're going to talk about, coerced divorce. It was signed off by, you know, everybody who's anybody, Rav Moshe Feinstein, all leading rabbis, everyone agrees to it, everything's brilliant, but practically speaking, it's very weak. In order for the 1983 get law to have any power, you need a very specific set of circumstances to work for it to actually, you know, make someone need to give a get. You need to have the husband caring about a civil divorce independent of the get, who's also initiating the divorce proceedings himself, in order for the 1983 New York get law to kick in. And for this reason, not even a decade later, a second law was passed. In 1992, I'll admit, I was not particularly aware of this law being passed. I was 4, I had more important things on my mind at the time, but I'm sure other people were probably, you know, may have read, it was a very kind of in the popular Jewish press at the time, and it was going through, but my impression is, this came about in a very different set of circumstances. It was a relatively quick process. It did not come under the same rabbinic scrutiny and approval by which it was passed. And the 1992 law has two parts to it in source number 2. The key is the first one. In any decision made pursuant to this subdivision, the court shall, where appropriate, consider the effect of a barrier to remarriage as defined in subdivision 6 of section 253 of this article on the factors enumerated in paragraph D. So they are saying you have to consider as a judge the next paragraph we're about to read when dividing assets. 253 spells that out. As used in sworn statements prescribed by this section, barrier to remarriage includes, without limitation, any religious or conscientious restraint or inhibition of which the party required to make the verified statement is aware, that is imposed on a party to a marriage, under the principles held by a clergyman or minister who has solemnized the marriage by reason of the other party's commission or withholding of the voluntary act. This is actually crucial because it means the marriage had to take place with an Orthodox rabbi, because Orthodox rabbis basically, and this is kind of a fascinating, is that if you are part of a denomination that has an alternative solution to the Aguna crisis, and therefore withholding a get is not a barrier to remarriage, because there are other denominations that have alternative ways of getting around. So if the husband refuses to give a get, or they don't feel the need, you know, they don't require mutual consent to begin with, then it's not a barrier to remarriage. The New York get law kicks in. This is actually a huge problem for people who were not Orthodox when they got married and have since become Orthodox, and then there is get refusal because the officiating rabbi was not an Orthodox rabbi, and if it was a denomination that does not require gittin to be given in order to dissolve the marriage, it's not a barrier to remarriage. So it's kind of a fascinating but crucial aside, but the key thing here is that when the judge divides the assets in a marriage, they can consider the husband's refusal to give a get as a major consideration in the division of assets and other financial requirements. So, for example, if it comes before the judge, the divorce proceedings, the judge can turn to the husband and say, you will owe $800 in alimony. However, if you give the get, it will be $500 a month in alimony. Alternatively, the judge has the right to divide assets. Let's say, you know, there's a house. They can say, you are entitled to no part of the house while you are giving a barrier to this remarriage because that's within my power. Only if you give the get will you be entitled to 50% of the value of the house. You can see how effective this would be in pressuring husbands because it goes after the most central thing, which is the money. It financially incentivizes the husband to give a get in order to get money, and it's completely at the discretion of the judge. The judge has the power to decide the barrier to remarriage is the refusal to give a get. That's what, you know, the Orthodox rabbi will tell you. This person cannot remarry under Orthodox, you know, auspices without a get, and therefore that becomes a major consideration in the division of assets, and it basically will force a husband to give a get if he wants any sort of financial benefits, financial redistribution, equitable redistribution, whatever it may be. If he wants that, he has to give the get.
I don't know if you got into the second level, but like, are there religion state issues raised by these laws?
So one of the other side issues from the New York get law is the fact that it sounds that some people claim it is a religion state violation, but it's crafted in such a way generally to avoid it. And it's not being challenged as a violation of church and state. So kind of the side issue, one of the other objections to New York get law, we're going to get into the main one in a second. One of the objections to New York get law is not necessarily religion and state, but state deciding certain things that should be within the Jewish community. So the example is kashrut.
Right.
It's really up to the Jewish community to decide what's kosher and what's not kosher. You don't want states deciding for the Jewish community what counts as a valid hashgacha or what doesn't. And there are laws on the books that create kind of complications with this, such as, you know, when we drafted the kashrut policy here, the language is very precise that they don't meet communal standards. Because you can't claim a certain hechsher is not, you know, acceptable or not kosher, because if it is considered by the state to be kosher, it creates kind of complications, and this is kind of the challenge here, is that if these things should be left within the Jewish community alone and people don't want the courts getting involved in kind of other definitions of Judaism. Think of in England over a decade ago when the government got involved in the question of who is a Jew, and that created complications with who gets to go to Jewish schools, which are also public schools, so it created a lot of challenges. And there are definitely those who oppose the 1992 New York GET law because it basically gives carte blanche for a judge to get up involved in religious issues. Someone cynical could point out most New York judges are Jewish, so it's less of an issue, and that there are some significant kind of religious Jewish judges. One of them's husband refused to give her a get for a period of time, so it's always interesting if she is doing kind of cases where the husband is refusing to give a get, she knows to ask. Most judges now in New York know to ask about kind of barrier to remarriage, but it creates a major problem by the very fact that it forces the husband effectively to give a get. He is told, you will either have to pay more money or give a get. And so the question becomes this concept of get me'usa, that a get that is coerced, a divorce that is coerced, is not valid. If you take a look at source number 3, we saw the statement last week, we read it kind of descriptively last week of the situation, but it's actually a mishnah, and it's kind of the ultimate mishnah that defines everything about get me'usa. A man who divorces is not similar to a woman who is divorced. Whether or not a woman wishes to be divorced, it's not her choice. But a man can only have a divorce if it is by his own will, if it is with his own consent. If a man is giving a get unwillingly, if he is forced to do so for one situation or another, then you have a get me'usa, a coerced get, and that is not worth the paper it's written on. It doesn't count. Even if the get is then given, in the eyes of halacha, the get was never given, the woman remains an aguna, she's still married to the guy because the get was never valid to begin with. And so, if the person, this is really the central challenge of get me'usa with New York state law, with New York get law, if the husband gave the get due to financial pressure from secular courts, that is, in the eyes of many, a perfect example of a get me'usa. And thus, 1992 New York get law not only doesn't work, but runs the risk of jeopardizing, in the eyes of some, basically every get given in New York state, because the get law could be invoked, and that obviously creates huge problems. Generally, most people don't go that far, but even within the community, you know, the modern Orthodox community, the Haredi community, the 1992 get law presents a serious problem in that if a judge decides to ask during court proceedings, have you given a get yet? And the person says no, well, in that case, you now have to pay an extra $10,000 a year in alimony, or you are no longer entitled to the division of assets I was going to give you instead. The judge is compelling the person through secular courts, through a financial penalty, to give the get. A couple of questions.
Giving them a choice. It's not a choice.
It's not the same as like holding a gun to his head or something like that. Or, you know, it's not saying you will never see your children again or anything like that. It's a choice. You're going to live a little bit less financially well off, or you're going to give the get. It's not a coercion. In the same way
that
he still has a choice.
Yeah, so this is part of the answer will be rounded out in a second when we get to the next few sources, but first Zoe and Larry, you have comments.
Oh yeah, but I mean in response to that, we saw last week that there were actual cases of coercion through violence and things like that
So
it's really like if you're looking to avoid having to give a get, then you can take this and you can say, oh, I put this in this framework of coercion because I'm being coerced financially. Whereas, I mean, this seems more like, it's not quite bizarre. If this is community standard, as you've used for capture, right? If the community standard is we want to view this as coercion, then this starts to become a version of coercion, even if it doesn't seem like it should be.
There's a difference between pressuring and coercion.
Yeah, so here's the thing, and this is why the issue with the New York Get Law requires a bit more nuance, because as you already pointed out, Jewish law recognizes as valid elements of coercion. If you take a look at source number 4, this is the Shulchan Aruch Evan HaEzer, which deals with divorce stuff. Elu shekofen ola hotzi v'liten ketubah. These are the situations in which we force a husband to give his wife a get. And then it's situations like misha lo nadlo reach hapeh or reach hachotem, you have bad breath. You're smelly. Or shechazaliot mekabetz, you go back to be a collector of dog feces. Mekabetz soet klavim. Mekabetz soet klavim. Or borski or liot mechateich nechoshet miyikaro. You're a tanner or a scrapper of copper from its source, you're a miner. Ve'imrat star teshev imbala. If she wants, she can stay with her husband. Basically, in these situations, we're talking about something we're going to get to a bit next week, which is basically the woman entered the marriage not expecting certain things. As the Rama says, he adds on source number 4, Ve'im yada bahen kodem shenaseit ein kofin lahotzi desvar of a kabbalah. If she already knew about this going in, it doesn't work. So that second half was put because originally I thought we'd have enough time to also discuss the Rabbi Rachman Beit Din, but we aren't going to have enough time to talk about that until next week. But that source, keep that in the back of your minds. It'll be back next week when we discuss it. But the key thing here is Halacha recognizes very clearly examples when you can force a husband to give a get. And also source number 5, the Aruch HaShulchan. We saw this last week. V'keitzad osin k'shadin noten shemechuyav legaresh ve'en yadenu tekifa lekofo v'tzurichim lekofo al yidei aruchat. When we require the person to give a divorce, but we don't have the power to compel him, then we use non-Jewish courts. However, there is a major difference between what's outlined in sources 4 and 5, which is the Beit Din's power to compel a man to give a divorce, and what's happening in the New York Get Law. The fundamental difference is that as Jewish law sets the terms of what counts as coercion, it also sets the terms of what doesn't count as coercion. As in, built into the very system of coercion is this legitimacy for a Beit Din to force someone to give a get. That does not count. If a Beit Din has sat and ruled and decided someone is halachically obligated to give a get, that is no longer coercion, because they're doing it because effectively God himself has decreed they give a get, and that's no longer a violation of your free will because you're merely doing what God is telling you to do. If you're giving the get in order to follow halacha, that's not considered a coerced get. So as long as it remains within the system of Jewish law, we don't run afoul of coercion. Likewise, if nowadays a couple has signed a binding arbitration agreement and gone before the Beit Din of America and the Beit Din agreed, you are obligated to give a get, without which you will be fined $10,000 a month, and the Beit Din goes to the secular court because this is how they enforce their power, and that is signed off at, and all of, and now you are obligated in the American legal system also for your $10,000, that's source number 5. That's invoking secular courts as an arm of Jewish courts, of Batei Din. The problem with New York Get Law is that that's not what's happening. It can be invoked independent of a Beit Din. It is entirely in the jurisdiction of the judge, him or herself, and there is never at any point a discussion of whether or not the get is required. And this is a fundamental part of the Aguna crisis. There is a difference between a husband who is not giving the get because the divorce proceedings have not moved along far enough for the get to be given, versus the husband is refusing to give a get and Beit Din have decided he is now obligated to do so. There is a middle area, which is he's ignoring Beit Din, and then that kind of, you know, Beit Din will then decide, well, you are obligated to give the get because you're ignoring us. But fundamentally, what can happen here is New York Get Law can invoke the need to give a get before a Beit Din would have decided so, without a Beit Din deciding so, and when they institute this financial penalty, even though it is in so many ways almost identical to what a Beit Din would do, if you don't give a get, you're going to have to pay $10,000. And we're going to see the halachic prenup will work along similar means in the final week. But the difference here is the secular courts themselves are invoking that power. It is the secular courts who are deciding that the person needs to give a get, not the beaten. It's not working within the system of coercion, of valid coercion versus invalid coercion. And thus, whenever you have another party forcing the get, that's when you have the risk of a get me'usa, the risk of a coerced get. This is, you know, in more of a nutshell than before, the problem with the New York get law is that it's coming, it's not just the person is being forced or financial, that's one part, but the other part is by secular courts, never with the consent of the Beit Din, never with Jewish law ever getting involved. It's simply two people go to, you know, a secular court and the judge asks, have you given the get yet? And the judge is like, well, you've not given the get yet. Now you have to pay $10,000. They are deciding a halachic matter to which they don't halachically have a right to decide. Thus the problem. It's a get me'usa. It's a coerced get. This is the problem that we arrive at. And for this reason, the 1992 get law was tremendously protested by the halachic community. Rabbis Shlomo Eliashiv and Shlomo Zalman Orbach, two of kind of the major halachic figures in the, you know, in the 20th century, both protested tremendously. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach described it as, quote, dangerous, and stated that it would be better if this law had never been passed. And it kind of makes sense, because if you think this is a get me'usa, then the get isn't valid, and then we are once again creating a situation where this person now goes about thinking they are halachically married, halachically divorced, can get remarried, can have a child, and then that child's a mamzer. People get very, very nervous about these kinds of situations. For this reason, that's the problem with the New York get law. Yes, it's still in the books, and presents an interesting complication nowadays for New York State divorces. Larry, you had a...
Yeah, isn't there a problem with going to court for the civil division of property in and of itself? If you're going to take this, the court must be an arm of the Beit Din at all seriously, then it seems to me you have to originate you're going for divorce in a Beit Din. If the Beit Din then says, we will delegate property division to the secular courts, that's fine. But otherwise, you've got this problem. Even if you come to an amicable arrangement of property, you still have flouted and denied the role of the Beit Din and created tremendous halakhic problems.
Correct,
right there.
Correct. There is a halakhic prohibition known as arakat of using secular legal systems, which is a fascinating issue in and of itself. But if you go to the secular, through the secular courts to divide your property, you have committed a halachic violation, but fundamentally you are free to divide. If you both consent to the division of your property, you've divided your property. The problem is when you go to Beit Din to decide an explicitly halachic matter, which is of no, which a secular court would never have any interest in, You don't have to go to a Beit Din to divide assets in divorce. You could just decide it amongst yourselves. You know, just generally it tends to go through, you know, some other measure. And this is kind of the question of Archaot is a separate topic we can discuss another time. But often people are entitled to make their own stipulations and to disadvantage themselves financially, even if Halacha wouldn't put them in the same disadvantage. The problem is with the get, secular courts don't do gittin. And it's, people sometimes ask with the Aguna crisis, why don't, you know, the ketubah? The ketubah is essentially, we talk about this, I don't get halachic prenup, but like, try taking a ketubah to a secular court of law. It's like, it's written in Aramaic, and look, two men wrote, you know, they signed it with their Hebrew name and who they are the son of. This is valid. No, you know, she's worth, you know, X amount of, you know, ancient currency. It doesn't work because secular legal systems don't validate religious legal documents. So the problem here is you are going to the secular court in order to validate what is a religious process. It's not just arakat, but it's also just a get me'usa because the secular is pressuring you. That being said, there have been defenses of the get law by major halachic authorities. The crux of the question really circles the issue of how do we define a get me'usa? How do we define a coerced get? When does it apply? When doesn't it apply? So for one example, you can look at source number 6, which is the Avnei Nezer. The Avnei Nezer, Rav Avraham Bornstein, he was a major halachic figure. He was an Av Beit Din. He was also a Hasidic Rebbe. He is, I'd say, the places we encounter him the most is Sukkos. He's like a big Sukkos guy. He has a whole book on Sukkos. I've mentioned it before in the shul. Israel stuff and Aguna stuff are like the classic situations you will tend to encounter the Avnei Nezer, but major halachic authority has a lot of strong opinions on a lot of things, and he's very seriously regarded. And he says the following. He argues that it's legitimate to coerce a husband to give a get for financial remuneration. Take a look at what he says in source number 6. V'nirali da'after l'ritva v'rivash t'sfirale. So fine, he's quoting other people. This is part of a longer discussion where he's started quoting other people. Hainu b'shehu rotzeh la'do'ima u'mechazika la'ishta. That we're talking about a case where this would be an issue, where this type of get me'usa might be an issue, is when the husband wishes to live with this woman and represent her as a wife. That's when we get concerned about get me'usa, because you're forcing this person to give a get when he doesn't actually want to give the get. The bezeh vadai lo ne'ema agav unsa v'zuzei. The vadai af im yitno la adam kol hon lo yigarish ishto. In such a case, halacha never says because of the coercion of the money he divorced her. Certainly, even if one gave a man all the money in the world, he would not divorce his wife if he's living with her. Aval ish zeh shebagad beishto. But a man such as this who betrayed his wife, v'azva mikama shanim, abandoned her for many years, v'adai svarahu agav unsa v'zuzei. We certainly do say that the coercion of the money persuaded him to sell the divorce. She'eno rotze baklal rak shahaya lo she'avud alav. For he doesn't desire his wife, he just wants leverage over her. Shalatochel elhinasei la'acher b'lo rishuto. She can't remarry anyone else without his permission. V'yachol lahotzi mimenu manon al yedei zeh. And he gets money from her for this. Ubevadai ne'ema sha'avor zuze girsha v'zeh mistave ma'od. We say in such a case, yeah, he gave the divorce because of the money, but that's actually logical. He draws a distinction between two situations. He says a get me'usa is where a husband wants to stay married to his wife, and we basically say, give her a get, or we're going to fine you, you know, $20,000 a month. And then he gives her a get. Of course, that's not valid. He wants to remain married. But in a situation where he no longer wants to remain married to her, that doesn't count. Then you can't really coerce a get when they're no longer living together. And this is a major consideration in the Aguna crisis. Generally, by the time we've got to a situation where someone's an Aguna, they aren't living together. The marriage has collapsed for all other intents and purposes. If they are before a judge in New York State processing their divorce, they are no longer marrying one another. You aren't coercing him to divorce his wife. He's already divorcing his wife. You're merely coercing him to give the get. If the only reason he's withholding the get is, as the Avnei Nezer captures quite well, to sustain the abuse or to extract things from her that is not his right to extract, that's not a get me'usa. It's not a get me'usa when divorce proceedings are already happening, when the person does not wish to remain married. And you see this throughout a lot of the halachic literature. If the marriage has already collapsed, then it's hard to say this is a get me'usa. He does not want to remain married to her. He's processing it happily through secular court. They are no longer living together. He has no desire to remain married to her. This cannot count as a coerced get. If you think of some of the most extreme cases of agunot, where the recalcitrant husband has gone off and using a very badly obtained hetamer rabbonim to allow him to basically halachically be in a polygamous marriage. If he's married a second person, again, he's not interested in marrying the person anymore. This is not, argue people invoking the Avnei Nezer, this does not count as a get me'usa when they are no longer married to one another. If the only reason the husband does not want a divorce is to extract money or to sustain abuse, you're not forcing him to divorce her. He's already divorced her. You're just, you know, nicely coercing him, you know, giving him an incentive to do so, that doesn't count as coercion, even if a secular court were to do so, because they're already divorced. And this brings us to what is the problem, the fundamental issue. We had in a nutshell the problem, then we had in more of a nutshell, and now the fundamental issue. With not only the New York Get Law, with so many of these issues, which is, it's an area of halacha where compelling arguments aren't good enough. And the reason is because of the stakes involved. And what you'll see repeatedly is the hesitance to rely on something like New York Get Law is not because you can't compellingly argue it doesn't count as a get me'usa, but you can't fully quiet down that concern that it is a get me'usa. And this creates a major concern because the stakes are so high. I thought of this. I even made one, a matrix. I think of this, and this is talked about. This is hardly my novel idea, even if I'm claiming the matrix as my own. There's basically kind of, you know, two different aspects by which halachic decisions are made. We could call them, you know, Rishut Hayachid, private, it affects one person. Rishut Harabim, public, it affects many people. And then we also have kind of low stakes, high stakes. So if you come to me with, you know, not feeling so well before Ta'anit Esther, the fast of Esther, I am not going to be so concerned about invoking those halachic authorities who don't think you need to fast. The stakes are so low. It only affects you. There's not really, you know, that much to be concerned about in relying on a halachic authority. In contrast, if you come to me on Yom Kippur, even if it's still, you know, just only one person, the stakes are a lot higher now, because if you don't fast on Yom Kippur because of me, on my head it is that you broke one of the most serious Torah prohibitions. And so, you know, even when there are halachic authorities, major halachic authorities like Rabbi Nachum Rabinovich, who argues that pregnant women don't need to fast on Yom Kippur, or nursing mothers don't need to fast on Yom Kippur, generally the halachic community is reluctant to rely on Rav Rabinovich, even though we'd rely on him for so many other things, because the stakes are really high. And do you really want people breaking Yom Kippur because of, you know, your reliance on just one person's view? The stakes are higher. Likewise, if it affects multiple people, even if it's a low-stake issue, but it affects multiple people. You call me on a Friday afternoon, you're inviting lots of people around for Friday night dinner, and you have like some sort of kashrut concern. But it's really not actually a kashrut concern. Even still, the fact that multiple people could be, you know, running afoul of this amplifies my anxiety about, you know, being, oh yeah, it's fine, don't worry about it. What you have with the Aguna crisis, and this is true also of the other kind of major controversial area of halacha, which is conversion, is it affects a lot of people, some of whom aren't born yet, and the stakes are really high. If you decide to allow a woman if you give a get through New York Get Law, where there is this concern that it's a get me'usa, and then this person goes ahead, nonetheless, they remarry, they have children, 20 years later, this child is starting to date, and let's say he's, you know, moved to a slightly, you know, more Haredi neighborhood, and suddenly he finds out that his community discovers him to be a mamza. That's a really big concern. That's a really huge issue. The stakes here are so high that it lends itself to a tremendous conservatism and a tremendous reluctance, because no one wants to be the person upon whose head people are running around potentially, you know, as mamzerim. Women are going to be engaging in sexual relationships, which in the eyes of halacha is going to be considered an affair. The stakes are really high. And this tension is borne out in halachic sources dealing not with modern day aguna crisis, but with the classic situation of aguna. If you take a look at sources 7 or 8, it's the classic case of Aguna, which we spoke about last week. A woman's husband disappears overseas or while traveling. No one knows where he is. And the Shulchan Aruch here is considering basically whose testimony will we listen to testify that this person is dead. And basically, will we accept testimony from people we would otherwise consider unreliable? And this whole discussion was brought into kind of a the reality of this discussion was brought out. I don't know if it's made it to American news, but there was a soccer player flying from France to England in a private plane with just one other person that disappeared. And so for the past 3 days, there have been search parties. And today, kind of the someone, you know, high up was basically like, he's dead. We've not found him, but even someone kind of in peak physical shape, which you would have been, is not going to survive, you know, the English Channel for more than a few hours. So that is literally the kind of situations the classic Aguna crisis brought out. Chazal debate, under what situations can we assume this person is dead? You know, if we saw him fall into a pit with lions, you know, and it's kind of, there's a certain thing of like, lions, no, he could have survived the lions, but the scorpions, he didn't stand a chance. It's like, who are these people who can wrestle lions for survival? Because it's not me. But nonetheless, the Shulchan Aruch here is discussing an otherwise unreliable witness who comes before a Beit Din and says, he's dead. I saw him dead. Do we follow his view or not? Tremendous debate of the unreliable witness. So source number 7 is the Ramah. Rav Moshe Isserles, the defining halachic figure of Ashkenazi Jewry. V'chol makom de'ika pelukta bedinin elu, azlinan l'chumra. Wherever there is debate, dispute over whether or not we would follow someone's testimony, we are stringent, we don't accept it. The Taz, the Tori Zahav, Rabbi David Siegel, who is one of the major commentators on the Shulchan Aruch and one of its most influential halachic figures, disputes the Ramah and quotes people who say the exact opposite. Source number 8. Deish pelukta bein rabuta bedine aguna azlinan lekula. That when it comes to debates, the situation of aguna, so people will often take this taz and many other situations halachic authorities refer to as aguna and then apply it to the aguna crisis, but remember it's classic aguna, still a great soundbite, but nonetheless, the taz says in this situation, we are lenient. And this is the tension between the Ramah and the Taz, is the tension of what do we do? Because on the one hand, we don't, you know, you can, the Ramah makes a lot of sense. In these high-stakes situations, we want to dot every I and cross every T because we don't know what situations, you know, could result from our casual application of the law, or from our imprecise application of the law. In contrast, the Taz's view makes a lot of sense also. At the end of the day, we are dealing with people who are suffering, and we want to do as much as possible to alleviate that suffering. And if we have an opportunity, if we have a window that allows us to alleviate this suffering, if we have a lenient opinion we can call on in order to help us, surely we should do so. This is the tension at the heart of not just today, but also the solutions we're going to look at over the next couple of weeks. If we don't respect the law, if we don't protect the law, its decisions are practically meaningless. But if we don't try to help alleviate those who are suffering, then everything becomes pointless. What's the point of having laws? And this is the inherent tension. There is also, side point, but nonetheless, that there are also two types of suffering. There is the suffering of the person who right now is an aguna, and then there's the suffering that comes 20 years later when she learned that the thing she'd been told was okay is suddenly not again, which is, you know, another reason that draws people towards a certain conservatism here, in that there is kind of short-term and long-term suffering, both of which could happen depending on the situation. And, you know, one of the strongest framers of this, it won't surprise you, was Rav Soloveitchik, who, when these kinds of things and solutions to the Aguna crisis were being suggested at the RCA convention, delivered, you know, a classic, you know, Rav Soloveitchik rant speech, in which he said the following. I also was told that it was recommended that the method of annulment be reintroduced. So we're going to talk about this next week. But another way to you know, solve the Aguna crisis is you annul a marriage. We're not actually going to talk about annulment, but nonetheless, it's another way of doing it. If this recommendation is accepted, and I hope it will not be accepted, but if it is accepted, then there will be no need for a get. We will be able to cross out this Mishnah, that halacha. Every rabbi will suspend Jewish marriages. Why should there be this halacha if such a privilege exists? Why should this privilege be monopolized by the Israeli chief rabbi in Israel? Why couldn't the rabbinical council do it just as well? And this, and basically his point here is that there is a broader systemic challenge that happens if we decide to rewrite the laws of certain things. And that there is not, there is no law in isolation that one can address without there being a domino effect. So the most extreme example is annulment. If annulment becomes the default way of solving, you know, of solving divorces, because now you don't have divorces, and apparently the Catholic Church does that a lot now, it annuls marriages. Yes, so we spoke about this last week, the Geonim applied it a lot because of the principle that anyone who gets married does so with the consent of the rabbis, and so if the rabbis basically remove that consent, the marriage no longer happened. But it creates, annulment creates a lot of complications because then, you know, we have all these children, they're not mamzerim, but they are nonetheless the children of, you know, illicit relationships, and that doesn't affect their status, but nonetheless there are other issues that are affected by this. And what you know, Rav Soloveitchik captures here, even if the bombast of this particular speech doesn't really appeal to me, is that the stakes are very high. And if we decide to alleviate, you know, one person's suffering, or a group of people's suffering by invoking a lenient opinion, we can't control, especially with other people in the Jewish community, other parts of the Jewish community, we can't control their own reception of that. We can't control the fact that certain other issues may develop later on in the future, and that's I've said in a nutshell far too many times, but that's broadly summarized. That's the issue with New York Get Law. There are plenty of communities, plenty of rabbis, who if a couple turned up, and they're applying for membership of the shul, and the person was married once before, and it was, you know, New York get law was how they got their get, that's going to be fine. But there are plenty of communities that were going to be like, hold on a second. New York get law, this is a get me'usa. This is a coerced get. You have children? Oh no, those children are mamzerim, and now we have a huge problem. The stakes are really high with this, and as we're going to see over the next couple of weeks also, the stakes are so high that it lends itself to a caution in application, that it lends itself to a general hesitancy to just happily apply certain halachic ideas to solve the Aguna crisis, because fundamentally the risk is that it's not good enough, and that you are then actually creating, especially with the Aguna crisis more than anything else, you are creating, you know, a greater proliferation of people who have the status mamza, which is a huge problem. And for this reason, there is tremendous caution in invoking the New York get law. Felice, I'll want your question in 1 second. Next week, we will continue talking about incredibly controversial solutions to the Aguna crisis by looking at the Rabbi Rachman Beit Din, where we will see an application of Kiddushei Taut, which is a marriage that was, you know, done under false pretenses. And hopefully, if we have time, the International Beit Din, which uses the principle of get zikoi, which is basically it's in your own interests to give a get, and therefore it can be given. But we will talk about both of those issues next week. But for now, that kind of concludes the discussion of New York get law.